This is episode 1-8 of the Software Freedom Law Show.
So, we're back to an episode of the Software Freedom Law Show, and Karen has missed her first show. She is out sick with a cold, so send your get well letters to podcast@softwarefreedom.org. I expect she'll be back for the next show. But filling in for Karen today, I have our now declared brief expert for the Software Freedom Law Show, and my colleague who traveled an entire 15 feet to be here with us today. How are you, Aaron?
I'm happy to be here, Bradley, and thank you for having me on the show again for my second ever podcast. I pledge to be the best expert briefly that I can be.
We want to hear a lot about your briefs.
Yeah, I'll tell you as much as you can possibly stand to hear about the briefs. Maybe we should just have a moment of silence, allow those of us, or those who are checking out, given Karen's departure, to just go ahead and turn off their media players now.
Or they can just fast forward to the next podcast in their queue.
That's true.
Karen will not be available in the show. We will not hear her voice. Actually, no. I will ask our producer, Dan, to use her version of the little copyright notice at the end of the show. So at the very end of the show, you will hear Karen's voice with our normal copyright notice. So at least you will have a little bit of Karen Sandler this week.
Stay tuned.
Or this bi-weekly. I always say weekly, but we're not really weekly, which really makes confusing problems. So, but we're not talking about your briefs in some sort of haha sense. We're talking about amicus briefs.
That's true.
Or amicus briefs.
The friendliest briefs of all.
That's true. Because of the Latin phrase.
Because amicus curiae. Am I pronouncing that acceptably?
Well, you see, this is the issue with Latin, right? So there's these two competing pronunciations. There's church pronunciation, which is what the Catholic Church says, which is, by the way, the Catholic Church is the only entity that still uses Latin as its official language. It's official language of Vatican City, as I understand. And there's also the classical pronunciation, which is what various linguistics folks and scholars believe the Romans actually pronounced, and then the church people argue, well, how do you know, because nobody was there, etc. And they use various etymological things to discover that. So I guess the two possible pronunciations are amicus would be the church pronunciation, and how we pronounce curiae, I guess. Curiae is probably the same in both pronunciations, and in classical you say amicus, because you pronounce those C's are all soft unless they start a word.
I see. So most lawyers probably don't have that background on the Latin, but I guarantee you that most lawyers also judge lawyers who pronounce it other than in a way
other than the canonical. Well, I've always pronounced it. Most people say curi or cure. What do most people say?
Listen, most of us see it in writing.
Yeah, but it's curie, because you pronounce the I and the AE. Technically yeah. Speaking, if you're in both types of Latin pronunciation.
Right.
Because it's, of course, genitive. Which is, anytime in English when you would say of the court, or of, anytime it's an of the something, or of something, that's genitive case in Latin. And Latin is a declined language, which means nouns have endings. It's so respectable for a language. I mean, we don't have endings on our nouns.
Right.
Except for plural, but...
Yeah, I read about this whole declension thing when I found out...
Declension
thing. Yeah. That when I found out that the plural for octopus is not octopi, but octopodes.
Right, because it's probably, what, sixth declension, maybe?
What I had heard. I don't know what that means.
Well, there's a whole bunch of different declensions in Latin. Different nouns have different sets of endings depending on what declension they're in, and... It turns out that amicus is second declension, which is most male nouns in Latin, and therefore it's the amicus amici, if you're doing classic pronunciation, or amici, if you're doing church pronunciation, and that's the plural of amicus.
So I think I'm forced to conclude that we've either gotten ahead of or behind ourselves here. We haven't even defined what amicus curiae means in English, which
yeah,
is...
Yeah, it's not that fun of a Latin phrase. It's not as fun as... Fili me boni belli.
Boni belli. I'm not sure I'm going to do that, Bradley.
Well, it means, so it uses genitive case, because boni belli is genitive, which means of the good war. And so if you use it in this case where you have a son who's come back from the battle and he's won, and you say...
This happened to me last week.
Of course, yeah. You know, well, I mean, it happens to people. And you say, fili mi boni belli, which is, of course, fili mi, fili me, is my son in vocative case, and use vocative case when you're addressing someone. And you can say, welcome my son of the good war.
And this concludes our episode of the Software Freedom Latin Grammar Show.
It's not Latin grammar. That was just Latin goofiness and pronunciation and stuff. And I also haven't taken it since 11th grade. So all the things I know about it are influenced by a middle school / high school sensibility, which is why Fili mi boni belli is so funny.
It's hilarious.
Yeah. So an amicus in our modern world.
Yes.
Amicus curiae or amici curiae. They are friends of the court. And what does
friends
that mean?
Of the court. It basically means somebody who is interested in the result of a case, and I think we explained this on the last podcast someone who's interested in the result of a case but is not actually a party to the case. And so an amicus curiae will submit a brief to a friend of the court, will submit a friend of the court brief to a court to essentially attempt to nudge the court one way or the other on the case, to let them know that this case is going to affect their interests, and that the judges should take, or the justices in this case, should take their interests into account when deciding the case, as well as the interests of the party.
And connecting this up to Software Freedom Law Show history, that the case in question is one that was discussed at length on some of our earliest episodes, which we'll link to in the show notes, because this was decided by a lower court earlier, and this is Bilski versus Kapos, Bilski versus the guy who had Kapos's job before him.
Right. So basically, Bilski's patent application was denied by the patent office, and so
he sued the patent.
He's
office.
Suing the patent office because he believes that he has an invention that is patentable, and so he was suing the patent office when Kapos's predecessor was in office, and now it's had to change.
Mm-hmm. And that this was actually decided, and Karen and I discussed on our previous show, was decided in which court was it that previously decided it?
The Federal Circuit. The Federal U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit.
Right, and then, of course, Bilski didn't like the decision, so he appealed it to the Supreme Court. And right. We actually all thought that the Supreme Court wouldn't actually do what's called granting cert.
Right.
Which, if you want to explain what granting cert means.
Well, granting cert just means that the court decides to hear the appeal, and the Supreme Court only takes a very limited number of cases every term. I think that it's down to, you know, I don't have good figures on this. Eben talks about it all the time, but somewhere around 100 cases or, you know, of that order.
They've stopped taking cases. In fact, people have theorized that the court now uses failure to grant cert as a way of basically upholding the lower court's decision.
Right.
Rather than hearing a case and actually making it the case of the land, you have all these different district courts that are deciding things, and then they're not getting granted cert, so they sort of stand for that district but never go further. And that's been the case with a lot of patent cases, and we all joke about the districts in Texas being very friendly to patent holders because they have good decisions there that don't necessarily carry over because they haven't been appealed up or heard by the Supreme Court.
Right. And so the common understanding is that for the last 20 or so years, or until very recently, the Supreme Court had allowed the Federal Circuit to be the last word and to essentially become the Supreme Court of patent jurisprudence. And recently, the Supreme Court has started taking an interest in the Federal Circuit's decisions. Basically, they've been granting cert on and modifying or overturning those decisions. And so,
because we had an amicus brief in the Microsoft v. AT&T case which was also a patent case that the Supreme Court heard. But the reason we were so hopeful about this particular case, and those who've been listening to us for a while remember from the earlier shows, is at least I tend to feel that this is the chance to get rid of software patents. Now, some people don't necessarily agree that even if Bilski's upheld exactly as it is, it will truly get rid of software patents, but I think it's certainly our best hope that we've ever seen in the history of at least my life of actually getting rid of these horrible software patents that we have happening right now.
It's certainly the closest that the Supreme Court has ever has come in the last 25 years to hearing a case remotely related to software patents, and so we're hoping that the Supreme Court will modify or overturn previous federal circuit jurisprudence that will...
Right, because I looked at... basically, our Supreme Court brief, which we filed as a friend of the court, the Software Freedom Law Center, our brief, as well as pretty much all the others of interest, or the major ones, both for and against, or taking neither side, all mentioned a series of early cases of in the Supreme Court. Right. I think that it seems to all go from Benson to Fluk to Diamond v. Deere.
Yeah.
Everybody seems to all the briefs. So we're going to talk more later in the show about the specifics of all the briefs. But when you read them, you'll see every one of them chases that line of cases.
Right.
So if you can explain a little bit, help prep our listeners when they go and read the briefs, if they can understand what that chain of cases did in the court.
Sure. So the Benson case, and I apologize, I didn't take down dates for these cases, but essentially they all date back to roughly the 1970s. Benson involved a patent application for a technique for translating between binary and binary coded decimal. And it was essentially purely an algorithm for translating between those two formats. And essentially the Supreme Court said that a numerical algorithm standing on itself, even if it's novel in the sense that, you know, it's only just been discovered by the applicant. Even if it's novel in that nobody has ever proposed this technique before, it cannot be patented because it's essentially a pure idea and has not really been reduced to practice. And the court sort of said in the dicta of that case that part of the
problem... Well, hold on. Sorry. Explain what dicta are. Because people are not going to necessarily know that.
I apologize.
Well, the lawyers who listen to us will, but the non-lawyers might not have heard that phrase before.
So there's the holding of a case, which is the part that's said to be binding on future decisions and on lower courts. And then there's the dicta, which are statements that are made by the court that are not necessarily a part of the holding. And in reality... There's no sure way of telling what is holding and what is dicta, and the court may in the future surprise you by upholding something you thought was dicta, or rather, you know, basing their holding on something you thought was dicta, or you know, ignoring something that you thought was a holding. So it's not a sure thing. But what I would call dicta in the Benson case is that the court said part of the problem with this patent was that it wasn't tied to any particular machine. It was an algorithm that could be executed on any general purpose digital computer. So that was the Benson case.
And then Fluk.
Right. And as a little side note to that, Donald Knuth at one point writing an amicus in, I believe, it may have been in the Federal Circuit in Bilski, but I'm not positive of that. Essentially, said that it's impossible to distinguish between a numerical algorithm and other algorithms. Mm-hmm. That all algorithms are essentially numerical algorithms, and it's kind of meaningless to call an algorithm a numerical algorithm.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think he's right. Of course, Donald Knuth is usually right, and I think he's definitely right about that.
He knows a little more about computer science than the nine justices anyway. So after Benson, the Supreme Court also decided a case called Fluk.
Fluk. I've been saying Fluk, but I guess it's not Fluk.
You know, I don't know. Okay. You know, again, I see it.
But it wasn't a fluke.
Down. No, but it's spelled like a fluke. Okay. It wasn't a fluke. It was a sound decision. And essentially, Fluk involved a patent for a means of setting an alarm limit for certain dangerous levels in a catalytic conversion process. So, but essentially all of the claims in that case were non-novel. They were based on prior art. All machines to do catalytic conversion, included all of the elements of the claim in Fluk, except that they used an algorithm to calculate the alarm levels, which at least the patent examiner found that to be a novel algorithm for doing that. But the patent examiner basically said that you can't have a patent over this process because the only novel part of it is an algorithm, and this would be tantamount to granting you a patent on the algorithm itself. Mm-hmm. So
that sounds like a good decision too.
Right. Yeah. Right. And they also attempted to limit to limit the effect of their patent. And this was clearly a response to the Supreme Court's mention of the, you know, limiting to a particular machine in Benson. They attempted to limit their patent to only the field of catalytic conversion in order to say, oh, well, you know, even if our patent is broad, we're going to claim only this field, so you don't have to worry about the deleterious effects of an overbroad patent. But the Supreme Court wasn't buying that either, and said that essentially, you can't patent an algorithm by throwing a bunch of other stuff in that's covered by prior art.
Of course, people do that all the time.
Right. Well.
We'll get to that, I suppose. So the next case that's often referenced in all these amicus briefs is Deere, or yes, Diamond v. Deere.
Diamond v. Deere.
Yeah. It's a German word now, so we have to do correct German pronunciation.
Yes. So. Bradley is our resident language expert.
Apparently.
Resident in this room.
I took Latin, German, and Spanish in high school, so I took a lot of foreign languages. So I'm pretty good in pronunciation in all of those. So.
Fair enough.
Although when I speak Spanish, all native Spanish speakers think I'm a Puerto Rican, which I take as a compliment because at least they think I'm a native speaker, right. But I think they mean it as an insult, although I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. I'm only familiar with the particular racism of our culture. I won't pretend to be an expert of other cultures. Yeah. So Diamond v. Deere was the, as you say, the sort of ultimate case in this line of cases that the Supreme Court decided before the Federal Circuit went haywire on patents. And it involved a process to vulcanize rubber. And as in Fluke, there were certain parts of this process that had been, you know, that were covered by prior art. People knew that, you know, if you poured rubber into a mold and heated it to a certain temperature and kept it at that temperature, that that process would produce a harder and more durable rubber. but what the invention in Deere did differently was that instead of having someone physically open up the mold and check the temperature and then close the mold, which introduced temperature variations that were that had possibly harmful effects on the vulcanization process, they attached to the mold itself some sort of coupling that gauged temperature, and a computer that constantly read the temperature and would apply more or less heat in order to keep the rubber at the right temperature, and ultimately would open up the mold when the rubber was finished. And so this process was novel because there was no process for vulcanizing rubber without physically opening and closing the mold. And so they had added something novel.
Right, because this was, I think it was in 74, 73, circa that time frame, actually when it hit the Supreme Court. So they probably did the process, invented it in the late 60s, which would have been the first time you could actually hook a computer up to something to actually have a control.
Right.
So the novelness test is clearly there. I still think that's, patents are bad, but I would probably agree that's a novel idea, certainly.
Right, right. And it produced a novel physical result in the world, which was just better vulcanized rubber, mm-hmm. because you didn't introduce this uncertainty of temperature variations by opening the mold. And so the challenge to this patent was that, well, you know, the heart of the novelty of the patent is this algorithm for gauging the temperature and telling the mold when to open. And the court essentially said that while there are similarities to Fluke in this way, that because this is producing a novel physical result, that the process as a whole is actually a better process for vulcanizing rubber, for changing a thing from one physical state into another physical state, which is sort of one of the baseline or one of the tests for patentability. That it was patentable regardless of the fact that it included a computer program as one element in a claim that as a whole was patentable.
So that sounds like that's really a place to think of the transformation test, I guess, where you're actually transforming a physical thing, you're using a computer to do it, but the patent is on the performing of the transformation, not on the software that happens to implement whatever computer part you need to do the transformation. Is that really what Deere holds, or no?
Well, Deere holds that taken as a whole, this process is novel and performs and results in a physical change. Yes,
and is so patentable.
That's patentable.
It does hold
the process is patentable. Now, the machine or transformation test that you're referring to doesn't really. Okay, so the machine or transformation test ultimately, I think, dates back to Benson, mm-hmm. When the government had submitted a brief saying, you know, what the basis for patentability in these cases is whether the algorithm is tied to a particular kind of machine,
not a general purpose computer,
and that excludes general purpose computers, or if it it produces a transformation of matter from one state to another. And the court said that these things were clues to patentability, but not necessarily, you know, the only clues or the test, the sole test. Mm-hmm. But so then there was this period. Should we talk about the history of?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious about it. So we have these cases, and it sounds like Fluke and Benson did reasonably good things with regard to not making pure software patentable. Deere is saying, well, these mixed processes are probably patentable, but it really, I guess, doesn't even speak to the issue of just is the software by itself patentable. So then how do we get to the point where there's so many software patents?
Well, it did. Deere,
oh, it did? Oh, okay.
Deere, well, Deere upheld the results in or the reasoning and the result in Benson and Fluke, okay, and said that software by itself is or essentially an algorithm is not patentable. Mm-hmm. But if you, you know, if it is a part of a larger process that actually as a whole is patentable and the mm-hmm. software is not the only novel portion of the process, then the whole thing may be patentable. Mm-hmm. And even though it's that, because that wouldn't be tantamount to granting a patent on the algorithm itself. So, so these cases more or less stood for the proposition that software standing by itself couldn't be patentable. And this is what we argue in our brief in Bilski.
But how do we get, so let's talk about the middle period. How do we get from Benson Fluke Deere, or Fluke Benson Fluke Deere, to having such a long period of time where effectively people think software is patentable? Now, we've often said on our podcast, and others have said as well, that, well, it's not really software that's patentable, it's business methods, and business methods can be implemented in software, therefore you yield software patents, but they're not really called that. So how do we get this period of the 90s, late 80s and throughout the 90s, where there's just incredible amounts of software patenting going on and continuing into today?
Right. Well, as I said, after these cases were decided, and maybe a little bit beyond the last case in this series, the Supreme Court more or less started ignoring patent jurisprudence. And so, you know, from the late 70s through the late 80s, they were just not accepting cert on any patent issues and weren't rendering any decisions. And so the Federal Circuit was essentially developing its own jurisprudence. And its rules were getting further and further away from Supreme Court jurisprudence, to the point when in, I believe, 1989, mm-hmm. The State Street case was decided.
Right, so that was just a circuit case.
Right, yeah, right. It was, it never went to the Supreme Court. And State Street involved a patent over, essentially a way of structuring, financial services. The spoken hub model, which essentially means you take a bunch of mutual funds and, then, you know, you pool them. And somebody's pointed out, pool them in a way that you are sort of balancing your portfolio mm-hmm. across them. Someone pointed out that what State Street essentially amounts to is, a means of, or basically it patents the process by which you can avoid, tax liability for partnership taxes. You can structure financial services such that they don't appear to be a partnership to the IRS, and you can avoid collecting taxes. So that's a whole problem in itself. Patenting the only means of, or patenting a means of evading IRS rules.
Or working your way around them.
Right. It's probably not the best result socially. But what it also said...
I guess it depends on your position on taxes, I suppose.
I suppose so. But State Street essentially said that that a test for patentability is whether a machine or process produces a useful, concrete, and tangible result, which, as you can see, is far, far away from, you know, the did you transform matter from one state to another,
or did you build a machine, computer,
yeah. Did you invent something? Yeah. Did you build something physical, or did you cause a physical transformation in the world? Instead, now we're talking about whether you've produced a useful, concrete, and tangible result. And they said that in State Street, the final share price for, you know, these, you know, your financial product that is a pool of mutual funds, whether that share price that you offer to the public or to your shareholders is a useful, concrete, and tangible result. That's what they held that it was. It was a useful result, and that it was tangible in, I'm not sure what sense. I've never touched a share price.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing about tangibility?
Tangibility.
Is that the right word?
Yep.
Tangibility in legal terms, because we also, this relates to copyright, where you talk about fixing something in a tangible medium
right.
as being something that decides copyrightability. Of course, typing text into a text editor is fixing into a tangible medium. Of course, I've never touched Emacs. I wish I could touch Emacs.
I wish I could hold it in my arms.
I really do, actually.
Yeah.
But the thing is, that's considered by legal scholars as fixing intangible medium, putting into a computer. So if they're saying anything that does something tangible, and if the general legal belief about what tangibility is relates to computers or just putting it into text files or that sort of thing,
right.
State Street sounds like it opens
the entire... I'm going to write down a share price here. I'm going to write down 1534, and so that's tangible now. I can read that on a piece of paper. And State Street wasn't a software patents case. State Street
was a business method.
Business method patent.
But it opened the floodgates for what we call software patents, which are really, in the U.S., business method patents that happen to read on software.
Right.
Because it makes this opening for pretty much anything you can possibly do with an idea to be patentable.
Right. Right. So whereas, you know, of course, I think you and I would agree that most software could be called a process because it is a set of steps for accomplishing some result. And despite the fact that the Patent Act says that processes can be patentable, you know, there were limits on patentability of processes, which excluded software prior to State Street and similar decisions. Mm-hmm. But yeah, State Street was seen as sort of opening the door because at this point, you know, if you can patent, you know, the idea of pooling together several mutual funds and calculating a share price based on the, you know, pooled value of those financial products, then you can patent anything that is just a process in a computer that produces a number. How you can call this anything other than a numerical algorithm, you know, I can't say.
So a question to ask, and we asked this question of Scott Peterson when he reviewed them. He gave us his answer, and Karen and I debated it a bit on the show we had right after the Bilski circuit case was decided. Does Bilski overturn State Street? Would it overturn State Street if the Supreme Court upholds Bilski?
Well, so what happened was, you know, after State Street, there were all sorts of, you know, decisions by the Federal Circuit and then, you know, rulings by the Patent Office in line with State Street and in line with the patentability of business methods and software. Then when the Supreme Court sort of started taking an interest in what the Federal Circuit was doing, they got closer and closer to, you know, to this type of case, to basically the business method patent and, you know, overturning Federal Circuit cases that went, you know, the furthest afield from the results in Benson, Fluke, and Deere. And eventually the Federal Circuit started getting the picture. And so, finally, in their decision in Bilski, they made a call. They made a decision that was in line with the early Supreme Court jurisprudence, rather than with their wacky business method and software jurisprudence of the last 20 years. So what you're asking is whether their decision in that case, the Federal Circuit's, who have finally done the right thing here, whether it overturns State Street. Certainly not explicitly that I've seen. I don't think they say we therefore overrule our decision in State Street.
Yeah, in fact, when Karen and I debated, she pointed out they in fact say specifically they do not do that in one of the footnotes.
Right.
But we were like, but it kind of does.
Right. I mean, so.
But at least reopens the question, so we can actually start considering a question of patentability on a lot of these patentable, previously considered patentable ideas where we lost in various different district courts about software being patentable. Right. So I guess rather than overturning it, it opens another step where we can start reexamining and probably eventually produce cases that might overturn State Street.
Right.
So it's a step in the direction of overturning State Street, probably more than it is a full-fledged.
Sure. I mean, I suppose you could argue that it modifies or clarifies State Street by saying, well, you know, what we meant when we said a useful, concrete, and tangible result
was machine or transformation.
Yeah, a machine or transformation. I could read that generously to mean that. But how they got from there to the result in State Street is a little harder to explain.
So the next step is, of course, Bilski to be heard, and this is where we get back to the thing we started with, which is the Amici Curiae briefs.
Yes.
I think in our next segment, we're going to talk in detail about some of the Amici Curiae briefs that we think are worth looking at. Of course, we encourage you to look at our own, obviously. That's our favorite one. But there are others that are interesting, both for and against and in the middle, or well, they claim to be in the middle, they're actually against. We'll take a look at those in the next segment. The other thing I wanted to add is this is a neat thing about the naming of cases. I just want to point this out as we've been talking about these names of cases, because people don't realize a lot of times that who it gets named for is not necessarily for the way that it goes. So Bilski is not our friend. He is the guy trying to patent something that should not be patentable. Of course, the case is named after him because I guess he's first, or it's just sort of been the canonical name that people use for it. We've talked about this before, about how people decide the names of cases.
Right. Well, in the case of Bilski, which at this point is against the patent office or the head of the patent office, and so that is the other party in the case. You would not name the case after Kappos because there are going to be hundreds of cases against Kappos, and right. So it wouldn't distinguish them.
Right.
And so we call this case N. Ray Bilski.
Yeah, and it's similar to the issue of I always point this out to people, Miranda, which people are very familiar with in the U.S. because it's why they have to say anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law kind of thing. Miranda was a criminal who was clearly guilty,
yes.
And the idea of getting your rights read are named after him because he was clearly guilty, but the Supreme Court let him off because he was not properly Mirandized.
Right.
Although it's anachronistic to say that Miranda himself was not Mirandized.
Right. Well, and in some of these cases, like, you know, Benson is Gottschalk v. Benson.
Mm-hmm.
I think we use Benson because we don't want to say Gottschalk. But in this case, that was two private
Benson
parties.
I would say Benson because I liked that show in the 80s. With Robert Guillaume? You ever see this show?
No.
Oh, you're so young!
I am so young.
Yeah. In the 80s, there was a television show called Benson, where it was centered around a sitcom centered around a lieutenant governor. There's actually a number of people from the cast of Soap, if you've probably heard of Soap, even if you haven't. You've never heard of Soap. Okay. I never actually watched Soap, but Soap is a very famous sitcom. It was actually designed to be a sitcom spoof of a soap opera, which is why it was called Soap. So a number of the people from that started the show called Benson, which was Robert Guillaume, who's a relatively well-known TV actor in the U.S., and he was the lieutenant governor. And actually, initially, was he just the assistant? I think initially he was the assistant, and then he became lieutenant governor. But his name was Benson, and the show was called Benson.
Robert Guillaume was not involved, as far as
I know.
I know,
but every time you say Benson, I hear the Benson theme song in my head.
But the point I was going to make is that...
You need to understand, Karen's not here, but we usually tangentize into talking about television shows. That's part of the...
Okay, that's our shtick.
I don't know exactly. Karen likes that word. I'm not nuts about that word, but we always try to mention some television program of some sort.
Okay.
Anyway, go ahead.
Enough.
Sorry, Benson.
Well,
it's called Benson because...
I mean, yeah, so there's two private parties there. Different courts have sort of different traditions for which party is named first. You know, when you first bring a case, then it's clearly plaintiff versus defendant.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be somebody challenging a patent versus the patentee. But then some courts, when it goes up on appeal, will reverse the names because, you know, now it's somebody appealing, and so they're essentially the plaintiff in the appeal. The Metacase. Some courts won't reverse the names, and so it's really not useful to look at the two names to determine who is whom.
And what name you should actually call it. So, okay, so enough of the meta discussion. In our next segment, we'll talk in detail about the specific amicus briefs in the Bilski case. So, Aaron, now is the time you tell us about your briefs.
I'll tell you about my briefs.
Okay. First of all, there are lots of people filing in different directions, as we said. And we filed because we have an interest for our clients who are free software developers, and they're worried about software patents. So we filed to try and make sure Bilski gets, I guess, upheld, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we would love if the Supreme Court would go a little further and say that in addition to this being a crappy patent, software patents are no good either.
Now, Ken, I guess the Supreme Court has free reign to do that. They can take it even further than they did with the previous court did. They can just extend that, right?
Yeah, they could. And honestly, we don't expect them to, you know, but if they uphold the specific test of the Federal Circuit, then we think that will certainly eliminate some software patents. They could go further. They could say that that test is too strict and they need to come up with something else. There are a lot of results that could come out of this. I think that there are not too many bad results for us. Mm-hmm. There are some neutral results and there are some good results. So
what is the primary argument of our particular amicus brief?
Well, our brief is split into three sections, and in order they go. Number one, essentially, you know, as you've said for a very long
you
time,
being
you being the Supreme Court, sorry, addressing the Supreme Court, as you've said for years and years and years, algorithms are not patentable because they are only abstract ideas, and simply putting them into a computer program and running them on a computer does not change that. You're just combining the abstract idea and prior art, and that does not a patent make. So that's our first argument. Our second argument is that software has thrived without software patents, that innovation has flourished, and that there never was any need for software patents to do that, and there still is not. And our third argument is that software patents, if you know, taken to their logical conclusion, could run afoul of the First Amendment because software is merely the reduction of abstract ideas to human language or speech, and so restricting those could be a restriction on speech, and that the Supreme Court should keep that in mind when deciding this case.
Okay, so I want to ask you. So I think actually the first point, because we talked so much about the history in the previous segment, that's basically giving that history of the Benson Fluke Deere situation.
Right.
Then the second one, it's really more of a policy argument than it is a legal precedence argument, right?
Right.
You're saying this is a policy the Supreme Court could consider. Now, how common is it that the Supreme Court will take that seriously, take a policy argument by an amicus seriously?
Well, a cynical legal scholar will believe that a judge will decide any case based on the policy that he or she thinks is best, and really will only pick and choose from the law in order to support that result. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think there are more sort of upright citizens on the Supreme Court than that. But it certainly is going to a judge's view of the proper policy is going to affect their view of the case as a whole. Certainly, no matter who the judge or justice.
Is this where people talk about judicial activism? Is that what?
Yeah. Well, judicial activism has been with us since the beginning, and I don't think that any amount of flag waving will cause it to go away.
Both sides argue it whenever a case doesn't go their way, basically.
Right. Absolutely. this all sort of stems from the clause in the Constitution which authorizes Congress to grant
promote
patents.
Progress in
right.
science and the useful arts.
Yes.
I oft quote that.
Right. So that's the idea behind patents and copyrights, to promote progress of science and the useful arts. And if patents as granted are not doing that, then those patents, according to some argument, could be unconstitutional, or at least the direction in which the courts and Congress have taken patents have sort of exceeded the constitutional grant. Now, it's really difficult to make the argument that Congress has exceeded the authority granted to it in the Constitution in almost any case.
So we basically have two constitutional arguments. One is that they've exceeded in the promote progress in science and the useful arts because they're failing to do that with the current software patent system. And we also make a First Amendment argument, basically a constitutional argument as well.
Yeah, but I'll point out that we don't actually make the constitutional argument that they've exceeded, that Congress has exceeded its authority, or that the Patent Office has exceeded the grant, because it's too difficult. Congress has broad leeway to decide what they think is the best policy for sort of implementing that grant of power. So I think that nobody's really making that argument just because it's so hard to make.
I see. But our First Amendment argument really is a hardcore constitutionality argument, right?
Right, yeah. And I'm told you're going to have a separate show to have
Evan on. We're looking at getting, I think Evan's going to record a statement about specifically about the First Amendment, you know, his view of the First Amendment argument. So we may have that in a future show. But if you can briefly explain the general, basically more as a guide for people reading the brief today.
Right.
How to sort of understand the arguments we're making there.
Absolutely. So historically, the First Amendment and patent law haven't come into conflict very often, if at all, basically because these rules that, you know, that were sort of cast aside by the Federal Circuit in the 70s and 80s prevented speech or thought processes from getting anywhere near patentability. And so this hasn't really been addressed much in historical patent jurisprudence. On the other hand, in copyright law, you know, copyright, which is a limited monopoly on the expression, on original expression, comes very close to the First Amendment all the time. And so there's a line of cases in which the Supreme Court has said, ideas are not copyrightable, because to copyright an idea would be to prevent anyone from speaking that idea, you know, no matter what their expression.
So, yeah, but you're switching from patents to copyright. Yeah,
right.
So,
I am.
Can you explain how the copyright argument ends up applying to the patent situation in this way?
So the idea is, first, both patents and copyrights come from the same clause in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The grant of power to Congress is the same for both. And the Supreme Court has said in its copyright jurisprudence that the First Amendment is a limiting force on that grant of power. That essentially the effect of the copyright and patent laws cannot be such that it limits limits free speech. So as I said, though, this hasn't come up in patent law very much. It has come up in copyright law, and so. In this line of cases, starting arguably with, help me remember the name of the case here. You know it as well as I do. Not Eldred. Okay.
I actually don't. I probably don't know as well as you. So.
You did Feist. Yeah. The case is Feist.
yeah. In fact, I know Feist so well that when they mention the musician Feist, I think they're talking about a Supreme Court case.
Right.
How could you even momentarily forget Feist?
I don't know. I forgot Feist.
of course.
Forget Feist.
I think all of us would like to forget Feist, really.
Well, I mean, we don't want to forget Feist.
That's true.
Feist is what teaches us that that ideas and facts are not copyrightable. Mm-hmm. In that case, the...
But it wasn't a perfect holding either, right? There were some drawbacks.
Well, you know, there are troubled holdings in every case, but essentially somebody was trying to copyright their phone book, and the court said that the idea of taking all of the names of everybody you can collect names and phone numbers and addresses for in some geographical area and then organizing them in alphabetical order, that is an idea that, you know, just because you've
done...
a series of facts. And just because you've organized them in some way and that you've put them in alphabetical order, that's not original enough to give you a copyright, because copyright has this minimal degree of originality requirement. And essentially, you know, the court said that the Constitution requires that people be free to express facts and ideas. They can't use your exact expression, but when your expression is basically the only way to express it, then they can. So that's what Feist said.
Do you think we should get Feist to write a song about Feist, and then people would know more about it?
I would love to do that. If only to you know, interact with Leslie Feist. She seems like a wonderful person.
Maybe we should try to do that. Let's get on that. Listeners, get on that. Write to Feist and ask her to write a song about Feist.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, we'll put the listeners on it. They'll take care of it. Soon we'll have a song all about a nice little folky song all about Feist.
Right.
By Feist.
Yes.
Okay. So you were saying, sorry.
Well, so Feist established that facts and ideas cannot be copyrighted because the First Amendment requires that people be free to express them. And so then building off of this, the Supreme Court addressed these issues again in Eldred v. Ashcroft.
Now, this is one of the, I just want to stop you here because this is an amazing thing. Because I actually didn't work in detail on this brief. This is probably the thing SLC does that's furthest from my area of expertise. As people know on the podcast, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't really know how to construct arguments for an amicus brief myself, and don't know the nuances of it, and everybody here, like Aaron and so forth, are much more experienced at doing that. So when I read the brief as a finished product when it was about to go out, and I was just taken aback to see Eldred v. Ashcroft reference. Of course, Eldred was a case that we were all horrified that it didn't go our way, and to see it being used as precedent to get rid of patentability, it made me feel like, God, I said, if this works, you know, Eldred was not for nothing, you know, kind of
right,
thing.
Right. So Eldred, if you'll all recall, was the case that that Lawrence Lessig brought on behalf of the Internet Archive, I believe.
It might have been before the Internet Archive was dealing with these issues. It might have been for the various free books projects that people were working on to put books into electronic form.
Well, it was essentially the plaintiff had an online catalog of everything of works in the public domain,
right.
And the
wanted to add more works,
right? And more works were about to come into the public domain, and then Congress extended copyright
retroactively.
Yes, in the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act of 1998, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so one of the arguments in Eldred was essentially that this was a
So you're talking about a holding specifically, or an argument? Which specifically are we talking about here? The what it held?
Or? Yeah. So Eldred essentially was arguing that Congress had exceeded its authority. Congress could not extend copyright because it was four limited times that Congress was authorized to grant copyrights, and they were making that essentially a grant of,
as Stallman coined, perpetual copyright on the installment plan.
Yes. Right. 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 Perpetual copyright on the installment plan, on the Stallman plan.
On the that's true. I didn't realize that phononic similarity of the installment plan. I don't think Stallman wants a plan of perpetual copyright.
Right, right. So there was also an argument, and I'll admit to not remembering precisely how the argument went in Eldred, but that this also was a limitation on First Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. And the court essentially said that no, by extending the term of copyright, basically what the argument amounted to was saying that, or at least the way that the court construed it was that copyrights themselves were a limitation on free speech rights, which they are. There's a balance between copyright on the one hand and free speech on the other, mm-hmm. because copyrights
Then they counter that argument by saying, well, if you read something that's copyrighted and you take ideas from it, you can go speak about those ideas all you want, or right. against those ideas, or nuanced views about those ideas, because your work, when you speak again about those things, is new copyrightable material because it's a new thing fixed in a tangible medium.
Right, right. And so essentially what the court pointed out was that copyright did not come into direct conflict with free speech principles because there were a couple of safety valves in copyright that left room for free speech. The first is the idea expression dichotomy, which says that you can copyright your expression of an idea, but you cannot copyright the idea. Mm-hmm. And second, the court pointed out that fair use doctrine, which allows certain uses for purposes, this is not an exclusive list, but things like scholarship and comment and parody, that uses like that could take, you know, actual copyrighted expression from a work, because they were such important uses that it was so important to allow people to use works in these ways that essentially the limited monopoly of copyright has to give way to the First Amendment in these areas. Now, in fact, there is no holding prior to Eldred that the fair use principles actually are motivated by the First Amendment. Eldred is sort of the first place where that argument is made semi-explicitly by the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. But the teaching of Eldred is clear. Copyright is okay, and it's only okay
Copyright's not necessarily okay. Right, but Eldred holds that copyright is okay.
In the view of the Supreme Court, copyright's limitation on speech is okay only because it contains these safety valves, the idea-expression dichotomy, that prevents monopolies on ideas and facts, and fair use, which allows certain uses.
And then in our argument, patents have no safety valves, basically.
Right, right. So these safety valves have... Well, now, the... In our argument, the idea-expression dichotomy still exists in patent law. Essentially, we, as the court held in Benson, you can't patent an idea like an algorithm. You know, an algorithm is essentially an idea in the abstract, and you can't patent that. So we, you know, we point out that that safety valve does exist, and that is an independent claim or an independent argument on which the court could decide this case correctly. But we point out that fair use doesn't exist in patent law. That safety valve has never been built in to patent law because patent law has never come nearly so close as copyright law to treading on First Amendment ground. So, essentially we said if you allow ideas to be, or the expression of ideas to be patentable, then you've come too close to First Amendment territory.
That's excellent. So, actually, I noticed that we have the text up as we're talking about it to make sure we get everything right. And I noticed I actually did contribute to the brief, which I didn't realize. Like, 3 weeks ago, somebody asked me of a good example of a book, a computer book that includes lots of code as part of its speech, because it's a book that's the speech about something. And I said, well, you know, the K&R book about C has tons of code that's part of it. And actually, that was used as our example. So I did make a minor contribution to the Zamacus brief, which I didn't even realize because somebody asked me that out of context, and I just was like, oh, yeah, look at K&R.
Yes, that
and,
was me.
Oh, that was you. Okay, yes. I couldn't remember who asked me. But yeah, so I did that, make a minor contribution to our brief, which is good. So we should also spend some time talking about the other briefs, because there are a couple briefs from our community, from organizations like the Free Software Foundation, who we work with from time to time, and also from for-profit companies that are on the side, or somewhat at least on our side, with regard to the patentability of software. So we should talk briefly about, first, the FSF brief, I guess, because they're most similar to us in the sense they're a nonprofit. So what are some of the major points, do you think, are worth mentioning from the FSF brief, and and that people should look at when they take a look at it? Is there something specific in there that you think's good? Good, or is how similar it is to our argument, how different it is?
That's well, we made a calculated effort in our brief to keep it short. Mm-hmm. We want people to get the gist of why software patents are incorrect and harmful in a very short piece. The FSF,
as Polonius says, brevity tis the soul of wit.
Yes. I would not call our brief witty, but it's certainly brief. It's a brief brief. The FSF brief goes into a lot greater detail on the specific harms of software patents to developers.
A bigger policy argument, basically.
Right, right. And it talks about the history of free software development and how it flourished in the time when software patents weren't allowed. And since, it talks about how absurd the situation has become, where essentially every something like 15,000 lines of code in Linux, there's a software patent infringed somewhere that the Linux kernel infringes some,
we don't know of any, right. I should be clear, we don't know of any case where Linux infringes any patents,
right.
Per se.
If all of the software patents out there that have been granted by the patent office
turn out to be valid,
then an absurd number of them would probably read on software as large as the Linux kernel, and certainly a whole GNU Linux operating system, that it would become simply impossible to clear all the rights to software to actually produce any software. This is a point that's been made by other briefs as well. It talks about...
they mentioned the data formats issue and compatibility issues.
Right, so. That essentially if anybody can take out a patent on a data format, then then nobody else can implement that, and software essentially cannot be compatible.
Right. That's a really excellent argument as well.
Unless you have a lot of money to pay for the patent, software developers don't.
Right, and basically it sort of hurts the advancement. It's sort of similar to our argument in the sense of hurting the advancement of the software industry, because the incompatibility of lots of software systems due to them trying to avoid patents or invent their own things that they can patent or whatever really causes a problem. So those are, I think, some interesting things to look for in the FSF brief.
And one more thing I think mm-hmm. that people will find interesting, if you flip to the last section of the FSF brief, there are some interesting quotes by, you know, the United States government, by various studies, and by courts and commentators in foreign jurisdictions about just how little the U.S. Patent system and its allowance of software patents has actually spurred innovation here. And some of those quotes, I think, are very powerful and worth looking at.
And I think there's a quote from Knuth in there, at least somewhere.
Yeah.
Donald Knuth. I'll hold that for a minute when we talk about the unfriendly briefs. But let's talk about one more relatively friendly brief that our colleague Rob Tiller, not our colleague, but our
friend Rob Tiller at Red Hat.
Right? Yeah. So Rob Tiller at Red Hat, who's a lawyer there, he's actually Richard Fontana's boss. He wrote a brief for Red Hat about basically in support of Bilski and against software patentability. Red Hat, of course, does hold software patents, which we don't like all that much, and we give them a hard time about, and are encouraging them constantly to be more friendly to free software with regard to their patents. But like Microsoft in the old days, they don't hold many software patents. Actually, it was pointed out in the FSF brief how few patents Microsoft held when they were innovating, and they were actually against. Bill Gates has famously made a statement against software patents in the early 90s. So Red Hat's sort of making that same argument that Microsoft would have made in the 1990s, that basically their ability to compete and succeed is hindered by the existence of wide and broad software patents.
Right. And so, Red Hat represents the sort of corporate side of free and open source software here, and their argument certainly comes from that perspective, and I think something that they outline very well is just the absurd situation where they don't want to have to deal with software patents. They don't want to have to take them out. They don't want to have to enforce them. But every software producing company with any sort of revenues is put in the situation where if they don't have a patent portfolio of their own to wield and use defensively when somebody comes after them for licenses to somebody else's patent portfolio, then they're left exposed to monumental damages in patent infringement cases. And so despite having no interest in protecting themselves with software patents, in other words, discouraging the use of their software by software patents, they've felt it necessary to take out software patents simply so that they can defend themselves from other people with software patents that they claim read on Red Hat software, but that they had never heard of previously.
Yeah, so I think it's really good to have a company out there saying the things that we agree with, because unfortunately, one company that people often think of as generally friendly to free software, in this case, is really unfriendly, which is IBM, the biggest patent holder in the world,
yes.
came also in with a brief, and strangely, their brief is on no one's side. It's neither for Bilski and saying Bilski should get his patent, nor is it saying that the Bilski should not get his patent.
Well, right. I mean, I think that the IBM brief clearly is. Maybe I'm wrong about this. It's been a few days since I read it, but clearly is opposed to the type of business method patent that Bilski is seeking.
Right, and they weirdly tried to make this distinction between, well, we're against business method patents. We don't think people should get pure business method patents, but software patents are absolutely necessary and important. In fact, it says that basically they believe that software should be patentable and is patentable. And therefore, basically, they're against us in that sense, because they're basically saying that they should have lots of software patents.
Right.
There should be lots of them.
So IBM ultimately comes down against the Federal Circuit's holding that you need a specific machine or transformation of matter in order to actually have a patentable thing. Mm-hmm. And they in order to distinguish themselves from the business methods crowd, because it seems pretty clear that the court is going to do something to narrow the patentability of business methods, but to also not come down on the side of an argument that would destroy any of their software patents, of which they hold way too many. IBM makes this tortured argument that it's easy to distinguish a pure business method patent from a a valuable patent on something like software, because software patents are technological. So what you need to look at is whether the patent is on something that is a technological innovation. Now, at no point do they define technological there. And in my opinion, IBM is counting on the Supreme Court and others who read their brief, including the clerks on the the clerks working for the Supreme Court, to view software as this sort of esoteric, technological thing, this magical technology that is, though we don't really understand it, somehow different from a business method, in that it is technological. And I think that IBM is placing their bets on the wrong side of the intelligence of the Supreme Court and its clerks in making this argument that somehow this word technology is the magical distinction. If the Supreme Court adopted IBM's argument here, then I think that software would be broadly patentable, as would all sorts of things. And it's not really hard to make a business method seem technological, because technology doesn't really have an accepted definition.
You mentioned magic in there, and spoiler alert, Harry Potter spoiler alert, speed about 15-20 seconds ahead if you don't want a Harry Potter spoiler. But imagine what would have happened in the Harry Potter universe if Expelliarmus had been patented.
Wow. Well, I mean, Harry himself would be dead.
That's really... So I wasn't going to go that spoilery. I hope they sped through. But anyway, okay, spoiler of Harry Potter over. Actually, the key paragraph I pulled from the IBM brief that I'm just going to read out because it's so disgusting. So this is an evil, disgusting quote from IBM in their brief. Quote, when the court announced a one-size-fits-all test for patentability in the process of declining Bilski's case, the Federal Circuit participated in confusion over its applicability to software patentability. Software is and must remain patentable subject matter, unquote.
Right. And so IBM is saying, essentially, hey, this case is not about software, guys. Do what you want with Bilski's business method, but this is not a software case. And let's not all get confused, because business methods and software are not the same thing, because one of them is technology.
Magic.
Yeah.
But no one is confused, IBM, except if you have your way, the court, because we all know what your interest is in having all those patents. And in fact, I was just disgusted also in the brief where they said that there's another quote from the IBM brief. It says, quote, in light of its sizable patent portfolio and diverse business interests, IBM can provide a balanced view of patentability. Come on. IBM can give a balanced view, just like an extremely wealthy man can give a very balanced view on poverty.
Right.
Because he knows so much about poverty, having so much money, and therefore not being impoverished.
Right. I think, though, that neither of these quotes is the most disgusting from the IBM.
Oh, really?
IBM
okay.
Brief.
These are the ones disgusting me the most. Which one?
I don't think we don't have it in front of us, but IBM essentially said that software patents have greatly aided the development of free and open source software.
That was sort of a takeaway, and it was, that's disgusting.
And their idea is that because they no longer had to rely on trade secrets and keeping their actual source code, in-house to prevent other people from using their ideas, they could release it as free software and keep their patents so that other people couldn't implement the same patents outside of their specific implementation in their free software.
Well, and that's just crap, because A, they don't give a patent license when they give this stuff, so people have to live in fear of IBM patents that might read on software they release anyway, unless it's under a GPL v3 or something that has a really clear patent license in it. And the other thing is that the idea that patents are disclosed, therefore you can learn from them. If you've ever tried to read a software patent, it's actually not easy to read it and understand what they're actually talking about. We have debates here about looking at software patents and trying to figure out, well, what software are they actually talking about? Because it's written in such tortured language, basically to just get it to rush through the patent office, that it's not actually disclosing the invention to the public. That's crap. It's crap. I sound like Fab now on Linux Outlaws, but I think it's horrible. Anyway, so let's move on to another horrible brief before I get too outraged about IBM. I can get outraged at IEEE.
Yes, IEEE, which, you know, should be the keepers of you know, open standards and
helping scientists. You know, you'd think that they're, people think IEEE, it's a scientific organization. A lot of people belong to IEEE in graduate school and then continue as lifelong members. But the thing is the truth of the matter is that they have really been taken over and controlled by their members who do get patents and engineers who get patents, and lots of engineers who work places get patents and get bonuses for it. So they have this financial interest. And of course, the main guy who is talked about in this brief, he's not actually the filer because the filer has to be a lawyer, but this so-called professor, well, he's a real professor, I shouldn't say so-called professor, he's obviously a professor, he's at the University of Utah, named Holar.
His name is probably Lee Holler.
It's double A.
Is that Dutch?
I know you've never seen Red Dwarf, but there's this episode of Red Dwarf where Rimmer thinks that he's discovered aliens that can, because these are hologram, thinks he can give them their real body. And he thinks he's discovered aliens, and he names them himself, and he names them Quagars. And then Lister's like, what the hell is that? And he says, it's double A, actually. So he's Hanar.
Does
double
that mean
A,
that
actually.
I'm Aaron?
Oh, that's a good point. No, yeah. But it's a double A at the beginning as opposed to in the end.
That is a distinction without a difference, my friend.
I just want to make fun of his name because I hate him so much. The real story is I'm being petty. I think there are
better reasons to...
Oh, indeed there are, because he basically argues that engineers are helped by software patents. And in fact, his most disgusting quote is I don't want to pull the quote up because it's too gross to even look at. But he argues in a footnote, footnote 31, I believe, where he says, well, these free and open source software people, they just imitate other people's software, and that's why they hate patents so much, because they only know how to imitate, they don't innovate.
Yeah, no, he actually manages to insult two constituencies in that footnote. First free and open source software developers by calling them derivative and not innovative, and second, the entire developing world. He compares the free and open source software movement to the developing world, and that both are playing catch up to the enlightened proprietary software
patented
developers,
yeah,
and the developed world, and that we're not doing any innovation of our own. And of course,
yeah,
you know, our
yeah, and it's so disingenuous for a computer science professor to say that because I'm not sure if he's exactly computer science or if he's engineering, but anybody involved in technology related to computing to say that, because you look at things like the Haskell language, which is one of the most important languages in the area of programming language research, was completely released as free software and completely innovative. Completely, they've invented new ways of doing programming, which a lot of people find interesting. It's a new area of research, and that's all done as open source and free software. So he's basically being disingenuous to the entire field of computing, and he's disagreeing with Donald Knuth, which Donald Knuth is a real computer science professor with decades of knowledge and ability, and this guy is just some random dude at the University of Utah who happened to get a PhD, from my point of view. I mean the main computer science, the most famous computer scientists are against software patents, so I can't take this guy seriously at all.
And I'll note that we take a pot shot at this brief in our brief in a footnote, which is certainly the most space it deserves. So if you want to take a look at our brief. I don't know exactly which footnote
it
is, but it's a
little
short
hunting
brief.
Project. People,
yeah,
people
there you go.
To find it. Yeah, so I just think that it's just not reasonable. I think that we really. I've always had this trouble with academic computer scientists. They don't. A lot of academic computer science is apathetic about this, but I'm really glad that there's people like Donald Knuth who are out there against software patents. And people forget that in fact, I'm picking on this Holar guy, but there are other computer science researchers that have hurt free software with software patents. The best example being the RSA patent, which it's interesting because RSA patent was granted right in that period between Diamond V Deere and State Street. And I was just thinking when we were talking in the last segment about that, like what would happen if somebody had actually gotten that patent in front of the Supreme Court in that time in between before State Street? Because State Street would probably, if you applied the State Street holdings to RSA patent, it would clearly uphold it. But if you tried to use the whole Benson Fluke Deere stuff to it, it would not hold.
Right. I mean, RSA is purely mathematical.
I mean, it's the funny thing is, it's the, you know, the whole thing about math is not bad. That's another thing the IEEE thing says is, oh well, computer science isn't math because you have mice and keyboards and stuff.
Right.
And therefore,
there are
math.
Algorithms that are numerical, and those might be math. But then there is information processing, and that isn't math because it acts on, you know, our data.
Which is totally bullshit. Because when you look at something like the RSA patent, it's the most almost the purest example of math done as computer science, because it's a mathematical algorithm about finding prime numbers and using them in various different ways as a public and private key mathematically to do various mathematical operations. And then when you implement that in software, you get this amazing ability to do cryptography with people that you don't know, and to be able to do private exchanges. You know, I'm sorry, be able to avoid private key exchange to have a shared secret and so forth. So the invention of public key cryptography through RSA is such a huge mathematical finding as well as a computer science finding. It applies in both areas, and yet it was patented for many years and it held free software back. And I bring this up. I mean, our podcast listeners have heard me rant about RSA many times, and the reason I keep bringing it up is because that is the danger of software patents to free software, and we don't see it actively every day because it's behind the scenes more than it used to be. But the whole idea of secure websites and variety of other things were held back in free software because of the RSA patent, because there was no way in the United States for us to implement it, and therefore it meant that there was all these restrictions on importing, and that was related as well. And so we were really stuck for a number of years with regard to inventing because of a patent that was holding us back.
And as the FSF points out, this applies to data formats as well. And right now, the free software world is struggling with video and being held back by the patent on the H.264 standard. You know, we'd love to be able to implement that in all of our software, but it, you know, we wouldn't be able to implement it in free software and distribute it in some countries without running afoul of the patent on the many patents on that standard.
And that's another thing to keep in mind. There's a lot of people who are quasi in the free software community who think that what we really need is patent reform. And IBM is one of them. They say in their brief that, oh, well, you know, we want strong software patents. We don't want these frivolous Bilski-like patents. We want clear and strong patents that hold up to the non-obviousness test and so forth. That's actually bad for free software. I don't think it's good. We don't want patent reform. Stallman years ago wrote an essay, which I'll link to in the show notes, called Software Patent Reform is Not Enough. And the reason that it's not enough is because strong weapons on the other side are still harmful to us. And the RSA patent was a strong weapon that hurt us for many years. Right now, in fact, we're better off with the confusion because, like, Microsoft's out there saying, we have patents on software and we're going to come after people for it. But the thing is, when they reach into their bag of patents and pull out what they think is a weapon, it may not be a knife. It may just be a piece of felt, and they won't know until they start stabbing you that the patent is actually going to be overturned because it was not actually a valid software patent, because patents are granted that aren't really valid software patents, even under current conditions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think your analogy to weapons is apt. The idea that we should be strengthening software patents and granting fewer of them is essentially the argument that we should give companies who can afford patents, which are, you know, nowhere anywhere near the free software developers, that we should give them a few nuclear weapons instead of a
lots and lots of things.
A lot of melee weapons.
Right, but they don't know, actually, the lots of weapons, they don't even know what they are. Right? I mean, these companies who have these patents don't even know for sure what's going to be a piece of felt, what's going to be a knife, what's going to be a nuclear bomb. They don't know. They've got all this giant bag of patents, and they don't know which are which. And I think that we're better off in that situation when our enemy doesn't know what they're actually holding. You know, it's to analogize poker, which our listeners know a lot about. If your enemy doesn't even know what his cards are, if your opponent doesn't know what their cards are, you can play a lot better in poker than if they know exactly what their cards are. I would love to be in a poker game where people couldn't look at their cards. I mean, I could win all the time, right? And that's how I feel we are with patents right now. But if they get stronger, we won't have that. They will know every patent they get. They won't get many patents granted, but every patent they get granted will kill us. So that's why I think that the argument for patent reform is just horrible. And I really criticize organizations like OIN that are out there saying, oh, what we need is patent reform. That's bullshit. We need the end to software patents. And I hope Bilski does it. How hopeful are you that Bilski's going to actually get us there, or at least get us on the road there?
I certainly think that it will take one step toward narrowing the, you know, the field of available software patents. It's a relatively conservative court now. I've talked to a lot of people who know more about patents, patent law than I do, who've done prosecution of software patents, which I've never done because I don't believe that they should be granted. Who believe that what we're going to get here is maybe, you know, a drafting rule that says you're going to have to claim a little bit more than, you know, than the software itself, but that in reality it won't change much how much software is out there.
And that was
but,
Scott Peterson's argument in the earlier show that I'll link to.
Right. But of course, excluding Scott Peterson, the people I've talked to are people who have a high stake in a narrow decision here.
Well, Scott Peterson, personally, I don't know how he feels, but his company certainly has such a stake.
Some patents. Yeah.
I'm sure Scott can only go so far in varying from his company's position. I think that's part of the question there as well. So we'll have to see. I really hope that this is a change. I mean, this is certainly, we're all hopeful only because this is the first time we've actually had a chance at this. Stallman has been talking since the early 90s, 91, 92, about this issue. I talked about it my whole time since I got involved, obviously being influenced by Stallman heavily when I started. And this is the first moment that we've ever been able to actually do something about patents. Patent pools have not worked. I think OAN's not working. And so we need something to actually end software patents in the United States. And I hope this is it. We went a bit long on the show, but I think it was real. I at least hope it will be useful to our listeners. I think you should sort of treat this as a reading guide for the briefs. I really believe strongly that there's not, we're talking about things that aren't really magic. I don't think the law is magic. I'm not a lawyer, and these things are very accessible to me, mainly because I have people like Aaron teaching me about things about the history of the cases and so forth. And once you learn those basic facts that we've talked about in the show, you can sit down and read these briefs and really understand what the court's deciding. And really, if you're a U.S. citizen, I know we have a lot of international listeners, but those of you that are in the U.S., this is a participatory process for you to watch and understand. And it's a hell of a lot better than watching some reality show, I think. So it's an opportunity to watch, even though you can't get involved necessarily. You actually cannot get involved now because the amicus period's over, so you can't go and file your own amicus brief. But you can watch what's happening, watch who filed, and then when it comes, people may not know this, you can get the audio of the Supreme Court oral arguments. So when there's oral arguments in this, we'll definitely be pointing to that and encourage people to listen to it. And if you prep yourself now and read these briefs and understand the case, I think you'll find that the oral arguments very interesting when they happen.
Well, and beyond that, you know, you can go further by whatever the result of this case, speaking out against software patents, and if you are working for a company that takes out software patents, refusing to participate in the patent hoarding process.
Yeah, that's an excellent piece of advice. You know, I know a lot of people get bonuses, as I was saying. I know IBM has a bonus program for engineers who file software patents. Look, it's not worth the money. Tell your employer, I'm not saying quit necessarily, because I know people, it's not a time when people go quitting their jobs, and not everybody can be as great as Jeremy Allison in that regard, when they don't like what their company's doing for free software, to quit. But you can say things like, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to work on that. That's not something I want to do. I'm not really interested in those bonuses. That's something you can do to help to at least mitigate the situation. And of course, encouraging your employer to publish the software as free software before any patent application is filed, that's a huge help too, because then it can't be patented. Well, it can probably be patented, but that would give us an opportunity to re-examine the patent or otherwise call it into question, because the stuff was out there before the application was filed. So yeah, that's excellent advice, and I appreciate you giving that to our listeners, Aaron, because I didn't even think of that, but it's good. So thank you all for listening, and Karen will be back in 2 weeks, we hope. She's probably already feeling better already, so hopefully she will not get sick again or anything, and we'll be back. And we may cover Bilski a bit more in our next show. We're not sure yet, but it's a really important case, and I hope people will follow it.
Yeah, and thanks for listening, and keep abreast of the issues and stay active.
And feedback to podcast@softwarefreedom.org. Thanks for listening.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
So if Diamond V. Deere held various things regarding vulcanized rubber, did they address the fact that Mr. Spock went back in time to teach people how to process rubber?
As far as I know, the Supreme Court has never issued a decision regarding prior art from the future.
Well, they need to learn about time plots.